Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to New Books and Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado, and I'll be your host for this very special episode. It's very special not only because it's my first one since the world went crazy, since the beginning of the pandemic, but it's also really special because today I have the pleasure of speaking with a dear friend and former colleague, Dr. Latrice Donaldson, and we will talk about her book, Duty Beyond the Battlefield, African-American Soldiers Fight for Racial Uplift, Citizenship, and Manhood, from 1870 to 1920. The book was published by Southern Illinois University Press in 2020. Duty Beyond the Battlefield investigates how African-American soldiers use their military service to challenge white notions of an African-American second-class citizenry and forge new identity as freedom fighters, demanding the rights of full citizenship and manhood. Dr. Latrice Donaldson is an assistant professor of history at the University of Wisconsin-Stout and is also the author of A Voyage Through the African American Experience. Latrice Donaldson, welcome to New Books in Gender Studies.
Thank you so very much for having me. I greatly appreciate the invite. I love that I get to do this with my friend and former fellow Tiger, University of Memphis, go Tigers. So thank you. Thank you for taking the time out to invite me and having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Yes. How are you doing? I'm recording this from my closet here at downtown Memphis. How are you doing?
Well, I am not in a closet. I am doing okay, though. I am here in the Arctic tundra of America, where it is actually still snowing and not outside of, or it is still, it was like 18 degrees this morning. So that's where I am. In Wisconsin, which I really do love. Really, it's a wonderful place. Wonderful. Good. Wonderland in April.
Well, I'm a tropical creature, so I don't envy you too much.
Yes.
But before we discuss,
It's okay, go ahead.
Before we discuss Duty Beyond the Battlefield, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what led you to write this book?
Oh, sure. Thank you. Great question. I am a African-American historian, but what led me to down this path into African-American military history actually stemmed from a book. It was Kristen Hokanson's Fighting for American Manhood. And I was intrigued by, it was the book discussed the Spanish-American-Filipino conflict. And the more I examined the book, the more I was wondering, and also I looked at, I was reading Gail Biederman's book, Manliness and its in Civilization. And I was looking at both of those books and how white men constructed their manhood. And it was very clear that they constructed their manhood by defining it against Black men. And so the project, I got interested in this when I was a master student at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. And actually, it completely shifted my focus away from my original thesis project, which was going to look at non-traditional slave masters. So I was going to look at Indigenous American slave masters and African American slave masters in South Carolina and Louisiana. But once I read those two books, I kind of went a little bit further, and I decided that there needed to be a discussion. There was something missing, and it was a discussion of how Black men constructed their masculine identity, how they constructed their manhood. And they didn't construct their manhood by comparing themselves to white men, the way that white men constructed their manhood by comparing themselves to Black men. And so I wanted to explore this further. And the more I looked at the military, the more I saw that that played a huge role in how African-Americans after the Civil War really grew to define their citizenship. And that's, you know, where I would led me down that path. Now, I've been a historian, I feel like all my life. I consider myself a seeker, you know, a historical detective, right? And I've been fascinated by all types of history since I was a little girl. My family is also from the Caribbean. I know that you're from Brazil, but my family's from the Bahamas, and so I spent a lot of time there growing up. And, you know, if you go to the Caribbean, you know, they have all these forts and old cannons and whatnot. So those things I always was drawn to and fascinated by. And pretty much I've been fascinated by history since I was, you know, very young. I love books. I loved reading, and I loved getting lost in history. So, you know, I even though I tried to be a lawyer, I thought I'd be a doctor, it always ended up me coming back to being fascinated by history.
Yeah, when the history bug bites you, it's hard, right? We try to go away, but it would keep coming back.
I know, like, well, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, sorry. What I was going to say was so I'll tell you the real moment that just got me, that I realized that I was, this is something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I was going through census records on microfilm, and I was being the research assistant for a book by Cynthia Fleming, In the Shadow of Selma. And I was going through census record for Wilcox County, Alabama. And I loved it. It was during a summer, and I was a Ronald McNair scholar, which is to help African Americans to get doctorates in different fields. And so that's when I knew that I wanted to get my PhD. This is what I want to do for the rest of my life, is the summer I spent researching census data.
Yes. Oh, I can see that. Well, you, in your introduction, you tell us that. Okay. That's what happens when you get old friends who haven't seen each other in a minute to do an interview.
Right.
I hope this is as fun to listen as it is to record. But let's get back to your book.
Okay, absolutely.
Okay. In the introduction, you tell us that the African-American soldier is of the second half of the 19th century is one of the most misinterpreted figures in U.S. military history. Why do you think that?
Well, for a couple of things. One, the common theme that I've always found in when people talk about Black soldiers, like the little 2 or 3 paragraphs you get in U.S. history textbooks, or the maybe chapter you get in African American history textbook, is that, you know, they fought in the Civil War, they were Buffalo soldiers, they fought bravely in the Indian Wars, and then they fought in World War One, and then they did Double V. And that's pretty much it, right? You don't ever really get this truly deeply analyzed or even simple sentence of how they constructed or why they did this, right? The one common thing that they said that they do is because, well, they don't have a lot of job opportunities, and it's really, you know, it was just best, you know, for them to go and serve. And I think that is just too simplistic. And also, when you think about how Black soldiers are constructed, being that we African Americans have made up military service since they were allowed to serve, consistently, our numbers have been at 20 to 25% in the military. And that's from the 19th century to the present. At one point during the 70s and early 80s, it was up as high as 40%. And the reason why I say that they're misunderstood is that people don't understand the motives behind their service. And oftentimes just leveling it off to economic necessity is gravely being short-sighted about the fact that there was a lot more to military service beyond just, well, this is one of the few jobs they can actually do and they have a certain level of freedom. I'm just kind of like, no. Serving the military is not easy, especially in the 19th century. You're living in the middle of nowhere, isolated. It is a hard, hard life. And the fact is that consistently what I've seen in the documents is that when they served, they weren't serving for themselves. Yes, there was yes, there's a certain level of security. Yes, there's a certain level of selfishness in that. You know, they want to take care of themselves and their family. However, always tied into, in the back of their minds, always tied into their service, their military service, was the African-American community, was what their service was going to mean to the African-American community, how this service was going to be constructed beyond their military service, but what they're going to do when they leave. In the speeches I've read, in the articles I've read, in the letters I've read, in the white officers who talk about Black soldiers, they're, the enlisted men, they talk about how, you know, these men, whether they can read or write, are very clear that their military service isn't their own. It's for the entire African-American community. And once you change that in the textbooks, then you'll have a different construction of how Blacks and immigrants and others use military service, because African Americans used it for a very different reason. A lot of whites who ended up in the military, a lot of immigrants who ended up in the military, you know, it was people fleeing. They were fugitives. They had to serve or go to jail. There were people who, like I said, there are immigrants who were just like, well, I got to do something. But the whole idea of the whole Polish race is going to, my service is tied into uplifting the Polish community. That's not something that is ever discussed. In the African-American community, military service is directly tied into, we have to do our best because it's for all other Black people. Everything we do has to be better. And if you change that, that adds to why I feel that, you know, Black military service is misconstrued and misunderstood.
Yes, and that was, to me, a wonderful contribution that your book did here, especially now that I'm teaching that U.S. survey course, and I've been thinking about your book while when we talk about African-American soldiers. So one thing I wanted you to talk about is because, you know, folks who study African-American history will likely be familiar with the long versus short civil rights debate. Mm-hmm. And you're clearly here siding with the long civil rights camp.
Yes.
I want you to tell us why. But okay. First, could you explain this debate to anyone who might be unfamiliar with it?
Sure. So the long civil rights movement versus the short civil rights movement, it's really about chronology, being that you have the 20th century civil rights movement, which the dates I think have been pushed back to the 40s, going into the 60s, beginning with, you know, the end of World War II, i.e. the Double V campaign, and then going into the end of the 1960s, or if you want to even go shorter with the short civil rights movement, the 1950s and 60s, going into maybe the early 70s. And that is dealing with the actual, you know, when the media is actively, you see it on the television. And so that's the chronology that is often seen in U.S. survey textbooks and scholars of the 1960s and 1950s, especially those who want to focus on the Black Power movement, for example. And one of the reasons why I am in the long civil rights camp is that you can see from the end of the Civil War, when African Americans are going to get, when you get the Reconstruction Amendments pushed through, these are the Civil Rights Amendments, right? That's the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, the 13th Amendment ending slavery, the 14th Amendment granting Black citizenship, and the 15th Amendment granting them the right to vote. So these are the Reconstruction Amendments, but they're also the Civil Rights Amendments, because when the Civil Rights Act are passed and the Voting Rights Act passed in the 1960s, well, what they're really doing is just really making it very simplified and clear that you can't circumvent what's already in the Constitution. So one of the reasons why I am in the long civil rights camp is that for me, what ends up happening, especially in the 1960s and 70s, is a culmination of decades of activism, because it never stopped, right? Blacks never stopped fighting for their rights. The moment that you have the pushback in the South, the lynchings, the birth of the Klan, and the terrorism, and against the Black community, the fact that Blacks are going to continuously fight to ensure Black military service, Black officers, all of this is directly tied into the civil rights movement. Black military service is directly tied into the long civil rights movement. One of the things that's always a watershed moment in the, if you focus or center your chronology in the 20th century, would be the Double V campaign, which is during World War II, which was victory at home and victory abroad. Well, you can't have the Double V campaign if you didn't have the No Officers, No Fight campaign from the Spanish-American Civil War, Spanish-American-Cuban-Filipino conflict, or the campaign to get the Black officer training school during World War I. All of those things have laid the foundations and pretty much led up to the progression of Blacks getting the Double V campaign, which eventually is going to push the U.S. military to desegregate. And it all has to do with the fact that that's a key component to me into the long civil rights movement. But, you know, that's not discussed because people have a problem with military service now in the 21st century. And that's unfortunate because I think it does a disservice to the activism that the early activism of the NAACP, the early activism of people such as Ida B. Wells, and the activism of Du Bois, and even figures such as Emmett Scott, Margaret Murray Washington, all of these figures, you know, had some voice. Even the anti-military campaigns of people such as Bishop Henry McNeil Turner, all of this should be included when you talk about the long civil rights movement. So this is why I feel that that should be where the chronology should fall. But, you know, I know that you can't do that sometimes in survey courses because, you know, people don't have the time to do that. But it's something that I try to incorporate. But, you know, you have to work within certain time constraints. So I understand that. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, yes. I'm curious now about then the time frame of how did you decide to instead of, for instance, looking at a particular war, why did you decide on looking at this period?
Okay, great. Thank you for asking. So one of the reasons, I think you're the first person to ask me that. So thank you for asking me that. One of the reasons why I picked from 1870 to 1920 was that this is directly after the Civil War. And this is the chronology for the restart and the final stage of the longest war the United States ever fought, which was actually not Vietnam War, but the war against the indigenous Americans. And that lasted, a couple hundred years, So the 1870s dated as the beginning of the Indian War campaign. And that is the last stages of it because it ends in 1890. And so that's why I begin it there. I wanted to go with the regular army and not the Civil War because that's a whole other genre. Like, this is a whole other thing in regards to the 250,000 African-American men who served in the Civil War versus in 1870, the 25,000, not 25,000 Black men, but the military size is different. The structure of the military is different and their goal is different. And so who these soldiers are in 1870 is going to be very different than who the soldiers are going to be in 1920. And that's what I wanted to show. And I picked that chronology because it's so different in just that short period of time that it just worked perfectly to demonstrate how much the Black soldier evolved over time. Also, the World War II is a much longer period, is a much longer war that has a lot more soldiers in regards to African Americans who served. And World War I is such, like, I had to decide what I was going to cut out in regards to what I was going to talk about with World War I, because even there you have over 300,000 Blacks who serve, and that's a lot. So, but the war was really short. So, it's all about the longevity of the conflicts that I'm looking at and how it's portrayed in the press and what the soldiers say about it, as well as the military policy and their fighting capabilities. I try to stay away from individual battles per se, because, there are plenty of military historians who will happily talk about the outflanking of this maneuver up that hill. That's not me. I will, however, talk about how Black soldiers defended themselves when confronted by white racist mobs when they are stationed in Texas or in Arizona, and how they would be willing to, fight and defend themselves and the Black community against that. That is more interesting me than whether or not they were able to outflank Geronimo over there in 1881.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. I already talked to you about that, but I think I need to come clean to our audience as well. Military history is not my thing. So I was really excited when your book came out, especially because it has masculinity in the title, and that's something I'm really interested in. Mm-hmm. But I was afraid, right? I was like, oh my God, will I like this? It's a military history book. But you hooked me with very evocative narratives that open the chapters, right? As you just was explaining, you have these stories about individuals. And so I was wondering, what types of sources allowed you to tell these captivating stories about these people?
Well, the soldiers, so the cool thing about studying military history is that the military is a bureaucracy that keeps tons of records. So one of the best places to always start is the fact is with the National Archives, of course, and the the U.S. Army itself, because they have been keeping track of their records from the very beginning. However, the other great place for me in which that really helped me to see into the mind of Black soldiers was the Black press and the fact that they followed these men, right? And how they followed them and how they reported on them. And it goes into why I decided to include manhood, a fight for racial uplift and manhood in the title, because Black manhood is tied into Black military service. And their gender identity, right, is being attacked constantly within the white press, within entertainment, with menstrual shows, and how, you know, they're portrayed as beasts and sexual predators and childlike animals, you know, who can't take care of themselves. And the uniform, right? You read in the letters that they write to the press, because one of the things that's important to remember, and one of the reasons why we have so much correspondence in certain areas in regards to the Black military, is that Black soldiers or Black units were not allowed to have military correspondence attached to them, compared to, say, old Teddy Roosevelt and the Rough Riders, who had a New York Times person attached to them, right? Black soldiers were not allowed to have any of that. In fact, you don't really get the first Black war correspondent to World War I. So the people who are actually reporting on the soldiers writing to the Black press are the Black soldiers and officers themselves. And they're very vocal and open, which is something you don't see anymore today in regards to the press, right? You don't see a lot of discussion from the rank and file private Black privates in the press, because no one, you know, they don't talk. However, in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, the rank and file private and corporal, some of them who used to work for newspapers like the Richmond Planet or the Cleveland Gazette, would regularly write back to their newspapers and report about their experiences, or the Black chaplains like Theophilus Gould Stewart, or T.G. Stewart, Allen Allensworth, George Prilo. George Prilo would write a lot of letters to the Cleveland Gazette, and he describing his experience and the racism that he experienced when he rode the train in his chaplain officer's uniform. And so their voices is what's going to, you know, help shed some light. And also court-martial records, of course, as well as the, especially when it came to World War I, the Military Intelligence Bureau, as everyone knows, or a lot of people should know, the Bureau of Intelligence, or the what would later become the FBI, the Military Intelligence and the Office of Naval Intelligence were surveilling the African-American community very closely and monitoring their morale very closely. Everything, any and everything that Black said or did that remotely sounded like they were against the war was being monitored. And so those records were incredibly helpful, as well as some of the books. Du Bois wrote an unpublished manuscript, and he had over 10 years of research that is at Fisk University, that it was incredibly helpful in helping me to talk about African-American service, military service in the early 20th century and in World War I and a little bit afterwards, because his book, which was unpublished, which was called The Black Man in the Wounded World, has over 50 or 60 boxes of research where he put a call out in the Crisis journal, which he, I mean, a magazine that he wrote for, he was the editor for, and asked for Black soldiers to contribute. And they did. They sent him letters and they sent him pictures and they sent him files and they talked to him and they leaked information. And, you know, all of that helped in regards to the sources. So the great thing about the military is that soldiers are, one, they have to be taught how to read and write. And eventually when they do that, they will keep records, right? At the Carlisle Barracks in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is where the U.S. Army Center is, there were at least 10 unpublished manuscripts, right, of people who thought they were going to write a book about their service during any particular, like several different wars, and they never got published. So they just donated it to the Army. And so the Army kept it. And so there's all of those records that are incredibly, were incredibly helpful in helping to reconstruct how these people viewed in really constructing their male and masculine identity, right? Because one of the things that I discovered when looking at, say, for example, the papers of Colonel or now Brigadier General Charles Young was that he wrote about how, while at Wilberforce serving as the military science instructor, that he wanted to personally help elevate the self-esteem of young Black men because of the barrage, the constant, that's what he said. He wanted to uplift the self-esteem of young Black men because of the constant barrage of racism and the language used to denigrate them. And putting on a uniform and all of the training that comes with being a soldier and being a warrior helps them to combat the racism of Jim Crow America. So that really helped all of those letters and little newspapers and court-martial records and unpublished writers, because they thought they were poets, but they were not, which is why they didn't publish. But it was all incredibly helpful. So it's a gold mine.
Yeah, the material just really sounds fascinating. And one thing that I also was really intrigued is this idea of mobility, right? This mm-hmm. is a book that takes us to different places. And as you said, you talk here about the symbolic value of being mobile. Mm-hmm. I would like you to tell us a little bit about that, but also that through this mobility and relocation, the Black soldiers are affecting the demographics of the places they're going to, right? Especially through interracial marriages.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, but also I'm going to start a petition for you to write a sequel on the women who marry these men, because I was fascinated, you know, by those stories.
Okay, so I would actually love to do that, and I'm looking into writing at least an article, because I was actually supposed to present a paper at the Western Association Women's Historian Conference in April, at the end of this month in Costa Mesa, California. You know, that conference was canceled. So I will probably just turn that into, or just work on and write an article about it. So yes, I'll definitely do that. But the mobility, yes. So for example, where I live here in Western Wisconsin, about an hour away is Fort Snelling in Minnesota. And in fact, the 24th Infantry was stationed there for several decades. And that meant that you had a regular rotation of African-American men and eventually them building their families and this is Fort Snelling is right outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul. And this would help to increase the Black population in these areas to the point where, in fact, one of the people I talk about, I'm actually working an article about him right now. His name is Walter Loving. He when he was a kid, his sister moved and worked for a judge, a state Supreme Court judge in Minneapolis. And he went to the same school as the judge, the son, the judge's son. And so he went to an integrated school. And so you have a situation where, you know, in Minneapolis and St. Paul, in an area like Minnesota, where segregation is not as prevalent because, you know, Black population is so small, you'll have situations where slowly, where the Black soldiers go, the Black community will follow as well. And he was greatly influenced by the presence of the 24th Infantry. He loved to go watch them, the band play. And sure enough, when he got older, he went and joined the military. He didn't have to. He could have. He was a brilliant musician, and he had the opportunity to continue to be a musician. But instead, he went and joined up with the military. Another situation would be a city like Salt Lake City, Utah. Utah, literally, the newspaper talks about how they know that once these soldiers are going to be stationed at Fort Douglas, that means that the caravan of Black people that's going to come is going to be there. And initially the Salt Lake City newspapers were like, oh God, we don't want these Black people. But then they changed their apology. They're one of the few places that issued an apology to the Black soldiers. And you have Black soldiers who are like, you know what? I want to stay. When I leave the military, when my service is up, instead of going back to Mississippi or Kentucky where they joined up, they end up staying in Salt Lake City, Utah. They end up staying in Arizona. They end up staying in California, right? In San Francisco, because they're stationed. The first set of park rangers in the early 20th century are going to be members of the 9th and 10th Cavalry. And they're going to be stationed in just outside of the, what are those big tall trees that are in California? You know what I'm talking about? Those really tall, I can't remember the name of them, but they're going to serve as park rangers in just outside of San Francisco. And then they're going to grow that community. And so even and especially in a place like the Philippines, in after the Cuban-Filipino conflict, about 14% stay in the Philippines and marry and have a whole community. And so you have this Afro-Filipino population in Manila in the Philippines that are directly related to the direct descendants from the Black soldiers or the Buffalo soldiers.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was something that again, because it's more in my field, so I was really interested in, is these men who stay in the Philippines and build relationships, get married, start families. You mentioned that this war in the Philippines was an opportunity for them to change their status as men. Yes. How was that?
Well, one of the ways that they did that was that you have this complaint, right? So some of the white soldiers wrote to and complained to their commanders about how the Filipino women preferred the Black men to them. And they preferred to have relations with them and preferred to, you know, be with them rather than be with white men. And one of the reasons why was how they treated those women. And the Filipino women knew that these Black men were going to treat them with a level of respect that the white men were not going to. And the other reason that they're able to actually just be men is that they can actually protect their women. They can actually provide and provide a safe environment for their women compared to, say, living in the South, where, you know, a lynch mob could come in and, you know, rape your wife and make you watch and then, you know, kill you or something. You know, you don't have those kinds of scenarios because it's the Black military is there. And yes, there are going to be some incidents between Black soldiers and white soldiers. However, what you're not going to get is a white lynch mob rolling up into a Black man and his Filipino's wife home, trying to come hang him or whatever, or rape her in the same way that they would have done in the South. And they talk about this, right? They are going to have children with these women. And instead of doing what the white, this is one of the reasons why the Filipino women would prefer Black men, was that they took their commitment to being the father of these kids very seriously. And so they actually provided for, some of them would send for their children and their wives, especially if they decided to stay in California, or the ones who decided just to stay in the Philippines and have a marriage. And they were able to earn a relatively well-off living in the Philippines. And all of that adds to how they're able to be men, right? They can protect their women. They can provide financially. There's a certain level of status that comes with them from being former members of the military and having a certain level of protection in regards to the Filipino government, because the Filipino government that's going to be established is going to be very pro-American. And so, the U.S. wanted Blacks to move to the Philippines, actually. And so, you know, they were encouraged to come over as teachers. Carter G. Woodson goes over and teaches, you know, the father of African-American, of Black History Month, spends some time in Manila teaching English and working and teaching in the schools there. The guy was talking about Walter Leving. He helps to create the Filipino Constabulary Band, which becomes this world famous band. And they tour the world there. It's going to be the first time an African-American is ever going to lead a marching band during a White House inauguration, because he does this during William Howard Taft's presidential inauguration. And so the Black community has this really interesting relationship with the Filipino population. And the Filipino military the Filipino population in some aspects still maintains a great respect for people like Walter Leving, because he wrote a song about the Philippines. He died in the Philippines, actually, during World War II. And the Philippine Military Academy is modeled after West Point. And you have this relationship that is very complicated with the Afro-Filipino population that's still there, and how they're treated. And, you know, what that means in regards to how, you know, being Afro-Filipino and how they're treated by the other Filipino population. So it's a very interesting dynamic in that they're able to protect their women. And that's a big deal to them, was that they're able to protect their women. Something that in some instances in the South, they're just not able to do, because when mm-hmm. their women go out to work in the homes of these white men, the fact is there's a very real possibility of them getting attacked in those homes. And the police force in Manila, the Philippine Constabulary Force, is littered with former Black soldiers and officers. And that's the police force. That's who's going to investigate if something happens. So, yeah, they're going to be able to provide a certain level of protection for their wives and their family that they're not able to do in the United States.
I find that that relation, you know, between the Black soldiers and the people in the Philippines really interesting, especially if we consider that they went in there to fight, mm-hmm. right? To fight against them. So mm-hmm. that brings to me a really important theme here in your book is this lack of, I think at some point you mentioned this lack of interracial camaraderie, right? These men, these African-American soldiers are very often called upon to fight against other people of color. Mm-hmm. You have, you know, Native Americans in the West, Mexicans, Filipinos, and Haitians. And tell us a bit about that. And what do you think prevented Black soldiers from identifying with other racialized people who are also being oppressed by the U.S. government?
Well, the thing is, though, they did identify with them. They, especially in, with the Filipinos and the indigenous Americans, right? They did not enjoy doing those things, right? They did not enjoy, especially if they were going to, for example, in regards to in indigenous Americans, they talk about the fact that some of them really did not enjoy what they would have to do in regards to rounding up and putting people on reservations, right? However, they also had to protect these reservations too. And so they, you have these two situations where they're rounding people up and putting them on the reservations. And then also they're going to have to protect these reservations from white settlers coming in. In the Philippines, you have the situation in which they are very much, because the Black press was so opposed to Blacks fighting in the Philippines, you have this very split down the middle kind of thing in which they oppose the American policy in the Philippines, but they supported the troops. And what that meant was that they say this and they write back to the Black press and say, look, we get it. We will carry this heavy crown with a load of disgust. However, we're going to still do our duty because that's our responsibility. If we didn't do this, right, then we would never be able to serve in the military. They'd find a way to try to kick us out because they tried. They consistently said that Blacks, you can't send Black soldiers to do this, this, and this. You can't trust them to do this, this, and this. And they knew that if they didn't do this, then African-Americans would never serve in the military. They would find a way to keep them out. And a part of your civic duty as an American citizen is being able to serve. And so that is something that, you know, they always would weigh the pros and the cons, right? The fact that, you know, for example, something I always kind of find annoying, right? People love to talk about David Fagan and how he abandoned, he's this Black soldier who abandoned his service and deflected to the Filipino side. However, of the thousands of Black soldiers who served in the Philippines, only five were ever charged with desertion and only one ever actually joined and defected to the Philippines, and that was David Fagan. And that is something that is very important to understand. African Americans always had the lowest desertion rate. And it wasn't because they were just so gung-ho about American policy. They always did it out of the larger picture, right? And so the situation also comes from, you have to take into account that these men are being led by a very westernized military strategy, being that this is a very Eurocentric, oh, we're going to go in and they are going to buy into this idea about where we're Americans and we're going to help make you better. They mm-hmm. still have that mentality that still is there, right? Because Americans love to go around the world telling them how we're the greatest country in the world or whatever. And you're Brazilian, right? And so you're kind of like, you're Brazilian, you're kind of like, well, I think Brazil is the greatest country in the world. So, you know, I
definitely
disagree.
Not now.
No, well, no, not now. Well, come on. Well, I definitely don't think America is the greatest country in the world right now. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's, but you have this, that, you know, they're very proud to wear it. There's a thing that happens to these men when they put on that uniform. And it's something that is very hard to comprehend, especially when you're dealing with scholars of the 21st century who write things and refer to American imperialist policy. Yes, it's very much related to settler colonialism. Absolutely. American imperialism in the Philippines. Absolutely. However, these guys didn't see it all tied into as being black and white. Oh, this is a bad, unjust war. I'm not going to do my job. No, they are going to say this is an unjust war. However, I still did my job, and I'm going to treat the Filipino civilian population with a bit more respect than the white soldiers. And they do that. And this is why they were so afraid of blacks defecting to the side of the Filipino rebels, because of the fact that they treated the civilian population very differently than the white soldiers did. They didn't do the atrocities and the type of racialized, you know, they called them the N-word, all this stuff. They didn't treat them that way. And the Filipinos knew that. And so they were always suspicious of the fact that they were so friendly with the Filipino population, or they were so friendly in regards to going to Mexico, right? Because the thing that people don't like to talk about is the Afro-Mexican population that lived there, right? All those runaway slaves who didn't run north, who ran south, and the fact that they have that population there. And then they choose to settle in places like El Paso. El Paso's racial dynamic at the turn of the century is very different than the racial dynamic of Houston, because of the amount of black soldiers who were stationed there. And, you know, you have these things that people have to consider in regards to looking at a much larger picture. Also, you know, they're able to be a little bit more political in their protest to America's policy in the Philippines, being that, you know, so they, I talk about in the book that, what happened in Hawaii, right? So they, black soldiers would routinely go to Hawaii and pay homage and respect to Queen Lala Kalani. I think I may have butchered that. I'm sorry, Hawaiians, I apologize. But they go and pay respect to her in Hawaii and pay homage to her because they, you know that her land was stolen by the U.S. government by the Dole family, and eventually annexed by the U.S. And so, you know, they try to do things to pay homage to the indigenous populations and where they're going, to the Filipinos, whether it's the Hawaiians, even in Mexico. You know, they always were afraid. Right. That was always the big fear, that the blacks and the Mexicans were going to join up together along the Mexican border and somehow go to war with the white people along the Mexican border. So, you know, there is still a type of camaraderie that exists. But, you know, the fact is they were never going to betray, because the racist white hierarchy within the military was just waiting for blacks to do that. They were waiting for them to do something, the smallest little thing, so they could use it against them and banish all blacks from the military. And that is something that, you know, you have to really remember, being that if one person messed up, everyone would be punished. And they knew that.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about how these men went to places, right? This idea, mm-hmm. we talked about mobility, but you also talk about what happens when they come back, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, when in the war in the Philippines, they return, and as you say, they didn't necessarily have a hero's welcome. So I would like for you to tell us a little bit about this return, and how did African-American soldiers challenge the Jim Crow system? And also something that you also mentioned was the role of the returning African-American vet in the creation or the conception of that the new Negro of the 1920s.
Okay. All right. So one of the things that is going to especially crop up in the after World War One is, you know, you have Red Summer and this idea that Blacks need to be put in their place because they went and they were, you know, they're exposed, right? So when Blacks go to France and the French treat them with a type of respect that they never experienced before in regards to the United States, right? They are very disgusted when they return. And the white population is like, we have to make sure that they don't get too uppity. And so they go on this whole campaign to put Blacks back in their place. And then you have the situations where you have Black soldiers who return who are like, well, we're not going to just take this, right? We're going to actually fight back. And you have situations in riots, in the racial riots of Chicago and Washington, D.C., where it's, you know, whites are trying to come into the Black community to destroy it. And rather than them just turning their backs, I mean, well, rather than them, you know, running and hiding, it turns, they run into communities where it's actually Black soldiers are going to be like, no, we're not going to just take this. And they're going to use their military training to defend the community. And it's something that you end up seeing get repeated, right, in the 1960s. When Blacks, when particular Black leaders want to push Black self-defense. I mean, not Huey Newton, but the other one, Bobby Seale, was a veteran. And he helps to train the other Black Panthers in some of his paramilitary, you know, they create paramilitary organizations, right? The African Blood Brotherhood is going to be filled with, and the same thing with the United Negro Improvement Association, or the UNIA with Marcus Garvey, he actively recruits Black veterans into his elite little paramilitary guard, right? And the African Blood Brotherhood is a secret paramilitary organization that is one of the things one of my favorite shows. Did you watch The Watchmen? That was on HBO.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
So you watched that very first episode with the Tulsa race riot, right? And what irked me to no end about that, I loved the show, it was amazing. But what irked me was that you had this man who put on his uniform, right? Who didn't fight. He handed his gun to his wife. And I was just like, that's not what happened. During the Tulsa race war, actually, what it was called for like 30 years, it was called the Tulsa race war, was that there were Black veterans who were members of the African Blood Brotherhood who defended the young Black man who was being accused of whistling at a white woman in an elevator or something. And they stationed up, they created a perimeter around him. And it turned into an actual out-and-out battle. That's how the African Blood Brotherhood became famous, right, in regards to the Black community, was that they created a defensive perimeter and successfully defended this guy overnight. And this is why the Tulsa riot was so, you know, violent, was that it was an actual fight between Blacks and whites. Blacks didn't just sit there and take it. They fought back. It turned into a war. And if you go back and look at the newspapers from like the 30s and the 40s, it was called the Tulsa Race War. But the narrative was changed. And so one of the things that, you know, I want to really push in regards to changing how people, you know, one of the reasons why Black military service was so important was that these people returning back had a certain level of, and this is why it was so threatening to whites. Right, seeing a Black man in that uniform was just threatening to them. It triggered them to think that these people know that they have, you know, having that U.S. Star on their collar. Those things are, that visual of that was very triggering to whites who were like, these people are wearing the same uniform that I am, and they are not equal to me, and it. We have to put them in their place. And the people are like, well, no, we're going to fight back with you on this. And they do in a lot of these, in some of these incidents. And, you know, you can really look at the Black veteran organizations, like the League of Veterans that are going to pop up after World War One, even after the Indian Wars, we have incidents where whites are trying to attack Black, you know, even Black veterans, and other Black soldiers come to their defense. The fact is that there are more incidents like that than people, that people will talk about, but it doesn't fit a certain kind of narrative. Because one of the things that I really am bothered by oftentimes is how they portray Blacks as the victim in history. Like, we're a victim in American history. Right. We're kidnapped and taken into slavery. And then Jim Crow was forced on us. And, you know, we didn't do much. And then in the 50s and the 60s, we get Dr. Martin Luther King, the great Negro leader, to come in and liberate us. And that was it. And you're just kind of like, no, that's not what happened. Blacks fought the entire time. They never just acquiesced to any condition. Even being put on a ship, there are those who kill themselves. So you don't even have those kind of numbers. Like, you don't, there was never any point where Blacks were a victim in American history. But that's just something that is, you know, that needs to be changed. And that's, you know, one of my goals.
Yes. And your book definitely does that. One of my final questions that I wanted to ask was something that surprised me, is that how many times throughout the book, this discourse of upholding, fighting for Black men's manhood, because I assume that was something that you were reading between the lines, but it was something that these men were quite explicitly articulating themselves.
Right.
Was
yes.
that something that you, you know, did you start to write a book about manhood? Or was that something that was a product of your research? Well, as actually, you found these sources, you decided.
No. I wanted to write a book about Black manhood. The more I, you know, the language is there. And this is what they're saying. This is in the headlines. This is what Alexander Mitchell with the Richmond Planet is saying in constantly, right? This is what the editors in the Cleveland Gazette, this is what they're saying in the Washington Bee. The newspapers are constantly referring to Black soldiers and Black manhood. When they attack Black soldiers, they're attacking our manhood. They are constantly attacking our manhood. And how do they construct their manhood? Well, we construct our manhood and how we treat people, right? And so one of the things that I was, you know, when I was kind of goes back to what I was talking about in regards to how they treat Indigenous Americans, how they treat the Filipino population, even how they treat the Mexican and the Cuban and the Liberian population, in that, you know, they treat them with a level of respect that they, the best way they can, right? And so this is why you have a certain kind of admiration, right, from the French population when the Black soldiers come and help them, and then they see how the white Americans are treating them. And then the white military structure was so afraid of the fact that they were afraid that the white French civilian population and the white French military actually would take sides with the Black soldiers against the white American soldiers, because that's how much they dislike white American soldiers. And especially in the fact they were trying to force them to treat them with the same racist structure that the U.S. military had. Because unlike the American military, which didn't get their first Black general until 1940, the French had a Black general going back to the 18th century. And so, you know, the fact is that you have these situations in which Blacks are very proud. So, for example, even though Charles Young goes into Haiti and recommends that there be a temporary occupation of Haiti, there's also a recommendation for the temporary occupation of the Dominican Republic. The Dominican Republic wanted the U.S. occupation. The Haitians didn't want it, but there was enough violence between the Dominicans and the Haitians where they were like, look, they need to, someone, you know, needed to go in and do something. So the Marines go in. And unfortunately, it's horrible. And the fact that they're so racist in their suppression of Haitian culture, of voodoo and whatnot. However, one of the things that is appreciated about Haitian culture is Toussaint l'Ouverture, right? Charles Young writes a play about Toussaint l'Ouverture. You have Black high schools and they have plays, and constantly in the Black newspapers, there are always profiles about the Haitian Revolution and Toussaint l'Ouverture or Antonio Maceo from the Cuban Revolution. They are very much aware of people of color in different parts of the world, right? They even have this really interesting relationship with the Japanese, especially after the World War I, the Treaty of Versailles, peace talks, right? Du Bois goes to Japan several times. And so, you know, when the Japanese are like, look, you know, you need to come up with some kind of, you know, resolution in regards to people of color around the world. And, you know, Woodrow Wilson, with his racist self, completely dismisses it, right? But one of the things that is always there is that Black manhood is tied into directly how they treat other groups, how they treat other people. And that military service, when Black military service is attacked, is one of the attacks on Black manhood. And so tying all of that into military service and tying how they treat different groups of people and how they try to relate to different groups of people adds to it. And that's important, right? Because they're, Black soldiers are able to travel the world and introduce, I mean, they're going to be the group to introduce jazz to Europe. And that's a big deal. And they're going to be the first group of people that some white people, you know, first group of African Americans that they'll ever see. And they deal with the stupid racist questions like everyone else. However, I mean, you know, you should read some of the letters like, oh, do you have a tail? Like, what? What are you asking me? Do you have a tail? Yeah, a tail somewhere. You know what? Never mind. I was going to do a totally bad joke there. But you have but you have all of these really interesting, nuanced ways of how they construct their masculine identity. And it's not to the denigration of whites. It's to the upliftment of their community and doing their very best to be as considerate to other groups, like the civilian Philippine population, which they talk about. The fact that the civilian Filipino press talk about how they rather have Black troops, which is one of the reasons why they kept Black troops stationed there. And even in regards to how they deal with the Mexican punitive expedition going into Mexico, they were actually some of the best trained soldiers in the military. So, all of that is tied into their identity, their masculine identity. And it's very important that when they put on that uniform and how they treat different groups, they know that they are being a reflection of the entire Black community. And so they have to treat, you know, these people certain ways. So hopefully I answered everything.
Yes. So there's so much more I wanted to ask, but we're sort of running out of time. So I don't want us to go without you telling a little bit of what are you working on next. And if you will, tell us about the Blardy Report.
Oh, awesome. Thank you for asking. So right now I'm working on two projects in the works. One is I'm a co-author, and it's the history of Black chaplains. So, and it will be with my co-author, my mentor, my academic dad. His name is George Wright. He is the department chair at York College. And we're going to write a history of Black chaplains from 1861 to 1945. And I think that it's going to be a game changer in how, you know, we even talk about Black chaplains, because it's not something that you talk about. So we're gonna change the game there, right? Like I said, I'm working on an article on Walter Loving. I'm also working on a book in regards to, it's in the developmental stage right now, but it's going to be about Harriet Tubman. And I never thought I'd write a book about Harriet Tubman, but I just never thought I would do it. However, we're going to see where that one goes. Now, the Blurry Report is my pop culture blog that I run with one of my former students. He's the co-editor. His name is Deshaun Gaines. And it's about pretty much everything relating to Black people in pop culture. And so, you know, we talk about music. We talk about, you know, Black Panther. We talk about R. Kelly. We talked about the Boondocks. We talk about who should play Storm, because in the next X-Men franchise, I don't know what they're going to do, because now that X-Men is now a part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because, you know, the Disney bought up Fox. I'm not entirely certain that I want the X-Men to be a part of the MCU, because I'm not a big fan of the MCU. You know, there are, you know, people who don't agree with me. I don't like Iron Man.
Folks can read all about that on the Blurry Report. Let folks take make their own conclusions, because
Okay, yeah. Oh, you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Ebony Nerd. Ebony Nerd. And you can follow me there, and, you know, we can take this off the podcast. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate you. You're doing such a wonderful job.
My friend, thank you so much for taking this time to talk to me. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Gender Studies, a podcast from the New Books Network. I just spoke to Latrice Donaldson about her book, Duty Beyond the Battlefield, African American Soldiers Fight for Racial Uplift, Citizenship and Manhood, 1870 to 1920. The book was published by Southern Illinois University Press in 2020. I'm Isabel Machado, and I hope I'll see or hear you next time. Please stay safe, everyone out there. Thank you.